Silence!
Oppenheimer!
I think they're talking about us. No way.
I myself am strange and unusual.
This is Nerd Prey Radio!
Nerd alert!
These nerds are a threat to our way of life.
See, this is the stuff that brings nerds together.
So it's sort of social. Demented and sad, but social, right?
If I'm interested in it, then by definition, it is nerdy.
Are you in loser denial or something?
I'm a nerd, and I'm pretty proud of it.
My dad's a nerd.
And welcome to episode 25 of Nerd Pride Radio. 25 in Hindi, that would be Pachis, from whence we get the Indian board game, Pachisi. Because 25 is the highest roll in that game. And Pachisi, of course, is the basis for our own Parcheesi. And Sorry, and Aggravation, and the most awesome pop-o-matic game ever, Trouble. So ask me how I'm doing today. Go on, ask me. I am awesome. My name is Mike Jones. I am a D&D nerd, a sci-fi nerd, a comic book nerd, computer nerd, movie nerd, science nerd, gaming nerd. Plus, there's about seven other kinds of nerd I only wish I was nerdy enough to be. You're listening to Nerd Pride Radio. This is the place I go every week to haver on about all the nerd stuff I just can't fit in my brain anymore. My co-host today, a Rubik's Cube with only two sides solved. Welcome. First off, let's get to some meta talk.
Oppenheimer!
Yeah, Meta Talk is the portion of the show where I pull back the curtain a little bit, talk about the podcast, talk about the website, let you guys in on my deep, dark secrets. Normally, I would save this stuff for the meticulously plotted portion of the podcast, but you already noticed that there was no opening music, and so therefore, you're wondering what I'm doing. Here's the deal. I've decided I am not going to be using any licensed music in my podcast for the time being, for obvious legal reasons that people might worry about. In my own personal opinion, I would certainly think that the stuff that I've been doing completely falls under the terms of fair use, especially, you know, the music portions in the middle of the show where I play a couple of songs that I really like, that sort of stuff. I've always imagined that this is completely fair use, that it's in the context of a review of the music itself. I do not present the entire song, and it's always music that I love, so I'm encouraging people to go out and buy those songs. I'm doing nothing but giving them free advertising. You would think there's absolutely nothing wrong with that, and I still think that that's probably all acceptable use. However, I'm going to be careful until I get some more details and find out for sure. But then my bumper clips... And my bumper clips are a little more questionable. And again, I would make the argument for fair use that I'm using 5-second clips tops, and I always give proper credit. I give attribution to the people who deserve it. And again, I always use only music that I really like and music that I've bought myself, and I'm encouraging people, based on a 5-second sample, encourage people to go out and buy it for themselves. I think there's absolutely nothing wrong with that, in my opinion. However, there's always been that little nagging doubt at the back of my head, and so I've been doing some research, and it turns out that music companies and music trolls and people who own the rights to music and are looking to just make a profit off of it in any way possible, we won't go into my opinion on that kind of person, but there are people out there who are willing to sue and who are successfully suing and can make a decent living at it. And so therefore, I'm just not going to take any chance. I mean, there's people who have successfully sued over, you know, 12 beats of a song. And, you know, so is my 5-10-second clip going to be as questionable? Maybe. So I'm leaving them out, and that means today I am going to stumble through some of my bumpers because I don't actually have anything planned. I still think sound bites, spoken word sound bites from movies or whatever else, I think those are still acceptable, and I'm going to continue to use those until I find out otherwise. But I haven't found any clips to replace the ones that I'm taking out. So if I sound awkward, hey, that's what's up. But you love me anyway, and you'll stick with me, because that's what we do, right? But now to the meat of the show, I'm going to start off with updates. Hey, I told you last week that I was, well, actually, okay, not last week. It's actually 2 weeks ago. I took Valentine's Day off. My wife and I went out. We had a lovely weekend. And I am so sorry that I didn't have time to put together a podcast for you, but the relaxing time was great. We had a wonderful time. It was awesome. But part of what we did is I told you last week that I wasn't going to see One for the Money because the reviews were so terrible and we decided not to go. Well, we changed our minds and we went anyway. And turns out we had a great time. I told you we would. Low expectations, really low expectations. I expected this movie to completely, totally suck. And for the most part, yeah, it did in a lot of ways. But I knew that going in. I knew what I was getting into. And I went to see it with my wife. And every movie I see in the theater with my wife is immediately 2 points better because I just love going to movies with my wife. And turns out One for the Money was just fun. It was, I mean, look, the critics are all correct. It's kind of uneven. It's very simplistic and it's predictable, but it did have some funny moments in it. And yes, it would have worked better as a TV show, as a pilot for a show, whatever. Yeah, that's fine. But the thing that was stunning to me about One for the Money, for this bad movie that it was, the thing that was surprising to me is I really liked Katherine Heigl in this movie. I normally hate Katherine Heigl. I cannot stand Katherine Heigl. I have never found her attractive. She is just not my type. There's nothing about her that is redeeming in my eyes until I saw this movie. And halfway through the movie, my wife leans over to me and says, "Oh my God, you're completely in love with her right now, aren't you?" And I'm like, "Yeah, she's totally my type in this film. How did that happen?" There was just something about her. She went with the brunette look, and she shows a lot of skin in this movie. I'll give you that much. But just something about the attitude, and I don't know what it was, but I just had a great time. And I feel horrible saying that because, look, I am not recommending that anyone see One for the Money. All right. I saw it under unique circumstances that at this moment in my life with my wife going out, we had a great time and we had fun watching this terrible, terrible movie. None of you will. There is nobody in this listening audience right now who will enjoy One for the Money. Do not go out and see it based on my word here because trust me, you won't enjoy it. You will regret it and you'll be angry with me if you went and saw it because you thought I told you to. So don't do it. But like I say, something about it just worked for me and I really had a good time. I hate to admit that, but I did. So there you go. That's my update. Also, here's a bumper clip I can still use. I got some feedback. Holy cow. Someone came and signed up for the forums and sent me a private message just like I tell you guys to do every week. And who was it? It's Flip. Holy flip, it's Flip. Flip, we've missed you. This is great to have you back. This is so cool, Flip. Well, I'll read her message first and then I'll talk. Flip says, "Hi, Mike. I'm really loving the podcast. I also loved Animal Ball, and I'm glad I found this podcast. Good job." Thank you, Flip. I appreciate it. I'm so glad you came around. But she continues. "Just wondering if you've heard of
Llanfair Pwll Gwyn Gisgo Gerichwyr yn Drobwr Llantysilio Gogogoch
before." You know what? Strangely, I actually have. Turns out that unpronounceable name that you just heard there, which was spoken with a South Walian accent, according to Wikipedia. Thank you, Wikipedia. That is the longest place name in Europe. It is the name of a small village in northern Wales, right near the coast, and the literal English translation of that name is St. Mary's Church in the Hollow of the Hazel near to the rapid whirlpool of San Tisilio of the Red Cave. And this is an ancient village. It's been there since Neolithic times, although I'm sure the name is far more modern. Here was what was interesting about it. First off, I have heard the name before, Flip, thank you, because when we do our Holiday Hangman, Yancey and I do Holiday Hangman at work, I've described it on the podcast before, and we're always looking for tricky words and phrases and stuff that'll throw people off and things to put up there, and we all have a good time playing Hangman. And Yancey one year came up with this name because he found the longest place name in Europe, and it was an absolutely horrible word to spell because, for God's sake, it must use W as a vowel like 12 times in it. We don't do that, really. It was just, and we wound up not using the word for hangman because, honestly, why would anyone do that to anyone else? We just didn't. But it was a fascinating look at the word. But then the other thing is, I went to go look up this village online because Flip kindly provided me a link to Wikipedia for it. And as I was looking it up, I realized, I saw in its history that it was originally once part of the Kingdom of Gwynedd, in North Wales, which I immediately jumped on that and went, oh my God, Gwynedd, you mean like from Catherine Kurtz's Dorinni series? I don't know if I'm pronouncing Dorinni correctly. I don't care. If any of you have read the Dorinni books with St. Cuthbert, Cuthbert is from D&D. Saint, oh, what was his name? Anyway, it doesn't make any difference. Sorry. But anyway, the Dorinni is a great historical fantasy style series, and I had a lot of fun reading those when I was younger. And there's actually apparently a lot more of those books now, and I haven't gone back to pick them all up. I read like the first 9, and now there's even more than that. But the kingdom that they lived in those books was Gwynedd. And so turns out that the Gwynedd in the books is not the same as the historical Gwynedd. She only borrowed the name and probably some of the same feel of that historical era, but the maps lay out differently and the towns and principalities and everything else is different. But the kingdom of Gwynedd was just fascinating. And I'm sure, as I'm looking at the kingdom of Gwynedd, historically, it ran from like 450 to 1300-something, like 1340, something like that. So, you know, almost 900 years. And it was a petty kingdom that showed up just after the Romans left the area. Because originally, the village of Lilla, blah, 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 whatever it was again, a village from Neolithic times. But then when the Romans came in, it was part of the Roman Empire. And then the Romans left, and some local chieftain takes over, and he becomes the king of Gwynedd. And Gwynedd was only, as I'm looking at the ancient maps of it, like 50 miles across. Like, you could walk the thing in a couple of good days if you were trying. I mean, that's it. It was just a tiny little place. And I read through the history of it, and I'm not going to regale you with all of that, but it was just fascinating stuff. And I realized that, yeah, it's 50 miles across. It's this tiny little corner of the island, and there must have been hundreds of these through the courses of centuries. Yeah, how many of these? You know, this is one that, because the Romans were there, okay, we've got, you know, literate people, we've got records of things that happened afterwards of this tiny little kingdom. But how many hundreds of kingdoms like that must have existed through all of history, but even just in that area? And it was just fascinating to me. So there you go. That's
Sanvar Pushguin Gisco Gerichwir and Robos Santisilio Gogogoch.
But enough of that. I bore you guys with history every week, and you probably need a break from it now. But suffice to say, it was really, really cool. Flip still has more of her message left. The last sentence is, looking forward to the next podcast? Flip. Hey, thanks, Flip. I'm so glad you're around. Thank you for writing. Everybody else, look, seriously, I don't get that many emails or messages, so honestly, if you want to hear me read your stuff on the air, come to the message board, sign up for the forums, send me a private message. I'll read it. I read all of them. So, at least so far, until I become wildly popular, which I'm sure is just right around the corner. Next up, I don't have any music for it yet. I don't have a clip, but that's right. It's time for yet another installment in our all-too-frequent segment, Mike Was Wrong. I probably don't even need a clip for that because I've got a good voice for it. Turns out I read a letter from Akiva last time, and then later in the book, Akiva, again, who I've known online for years because he was part of the old boards, and now he's back around, just as Flip is. And then when it came up to a later segment and I blamed him for the podcast running too long, I called him Akira instead of Akiva. I feel horrible. I'm so sorry. I hope you forgive me. Please, please, I hope you haven't quit the podcast yet. Are you still listening? Because we need you. I need every listener I can get, man. Come back to me. And with that, it's now time for the meticulously plotted portion of this podcast. This is the time for me where I talk about whatever's been on my mind for the last week. If something strikes me as interesting during the course of my busy week, I add it to my master list, and the very best stuff off that list gets spewed out all over you guys every week when I record. You lucky dogs. Straight into it, though. First up, again, no music, but it's the Unnamed History segment. Today on the Unnamed History segment? Okay, you guys read Penny Arcade? Of course you do. Penny Arcade has the two characters, Gabe and Tycho. Do you know who Tycho is named after? Yeah, that's right. Tycho Brahe. Of course you knew that. Famed astronomer from the 1500s. And who is Tycho Brahe? That's what the history segment is about today, because I love this guy. He's absolutely fascinating. I first learned about him in high school physics back in 1987, and I just love this dude, all right? Because there's actually a couple of interesting things about him that have absolutely nothing to do with astronomy. First, he lost his nose in a duel, all right? I don't even know what the duel was about. Who knows? But the dude got his nose cut off in a duel. All right, and so then for the rest of his life, he wears fake noses. And they suspect that he probably had several different fake noses, but at least one of them was likely copper, because when they dug up his bones later, they could find little green stains that would have come from copper on either side where the fake nose would have sat. That's cool. So he wore a copper nose, possibly, you know, cheaper ones made of lighter materials, because a metal nose is a pretty heavy thing to be strapped your face all day long, but he would have worn the metal ones for decoration. And I just thought, how bizarre to be walking around with a big old metal nose. How cool is that? But also, Tycho Brahe died from holding his urine too long. Are you serious? All right. At the time of his death, Tycho Brahe was a rich, rich man. He was a Danish nobleman who actually technically lived in what is now Sweden, but back then it was part of Denmark. And at the time of his death, he was said to own 10% of all the wealth in Denmark. I don't know if that's an exaggeration or not. All I know is the man was stinking rich. And what did he do with all that wealth? Among other things, he threw lavish parties. And apparently, at one party, he had drunk too much all day long. And when it comes time to sit down for dinner, he needed to pee, but there was no time because he has to get right to the meal. You know, when you're the host, you don't want to be rude. And so he gets to the meal, and then here's the deal. Back then, you couldn't excuse yourself to urinate during a meal. It was just rude. You didn't leave the table until the meal was done, period. And now, Lord knows, he's an extremely rich man, probably a little more eccentric than most. He could have excused himself. He could have. And yeah, maybe it was embarrassing, but he could have. But he didn't, because he was a proper gentleman, all right? And so he held it all the way through the entire meal, all right? Probably hours. Imagine that, how painful that is. And then afterwards, the meal gets all done, and guess what? He can't go. Clearly, he broke something, all right? And he can't go, and when he does, it's just a messy dribble, and then he winds up 11 days later dying of an infection as a result. What a horrible way to go. The poor dude, because he wouldn't go pee. I feel so bad for him. But if you go look up Tycho Brahe, I wish, this is one of the few times where I wish I had some video to go with this, because Tycho Brahe, he looks a little mousy, a little doughy. He's obviously got a little extra weight on him. I mean, he was a nobleman. He could eat well. But the dude is light, light blonde, very Swedish looking. And he has got this walrus mustache, this mustache to die for. This man could kill underlings with this mustache. It's huge. Every painting of him has, some of the paintings will also have the fake nose, very obviously. Others, they paint it to look like a regular nose. But in every picture of him, he has a mustache that you assume can strangle elephants. It is huge. It's just impressive. But other than that, those are the fascinating parts of Tycho Brahe, and that's why I love him, is for that, because he died from holding his pee, he lost his nose in a duel and wore fake metal ones, and he had an awesome mustache. All right. But on top of that, dude also was a killer astronomer. All right, he subscribed to the theory that the sun still went around the Earth, and then all the other planets revolved around the sun, so it was this very complicated clockwork solution, because he couldn't accept the Earth might not be the center of the universe. And that's fine. All right. Copernicus finally fixed that for him. But what he did do was he looked up at the stars at night and realized that, you know, some things maybe aren't stars. Some things maybe aren't in the same place they should be. Some things are closer than others. All right. And so he goes to check star charts. This is when he's like 17 years old. And he goes to check star charts and realizes that through the course of history, there are no consistent star charts. Nowhere. All right? We've got a set of measurements from this dude, and he only does a few things. And then another set of measurements from this dude, and he only does a few things. And the ones that they do happen to do the same, don't even match up. You can't even line things up. So he makes it his mission in life to use his massive wealth and education to map the sky. That's what he did. And he spent his whole life doing it. And it's phenomenal work. Absolutely phenomenal work. And again, you know, his Earth-centric theory of the universe notwithstanding, the man did incredibly detailed measurements, showed all sorts of amazing stuff, did it all without the aid of a telescope. He is also known to be the last great naked-eye astronomer. This is before Galileo. He's an impressive man with impressive work. But all you have to remember is he wore a copper nose. Which brings me to my musicless gaming table. Role-playing games, video games, card games, if it fits on my gaming table, then I'm going to share it with you. Here's what I've got. I don't even know if this really fits in the gaming section, except it is a game. It's a kid's toy. Perplexus. Have you played Perplexus? Have you touched this thing? It is the most awesome toy ever. I run out right now and buy yourself one. No, don't even run. Don't even run. Go over to Amazon.com, look up Perplexus, and buy the medium-sized Perplexus ball for $16, and then thank me later. Well, okay, thank me in about 3 weeks when you finally get done playing with it, because it's going to take you that long. It is fascinating. The Perplexus, and there's three sizes of them. You got small, medium, and large. I've only played with the medium-sized one. It is a clear plastic ball, about volleyball-sized, maybe. All right, clear plastic ball, and inside it is a three-dimensional maze with little tracks and runners and holes for things to drop through and a steel marble. All right, and so it's got a little launch pad on one side, so you roll your plastic ball around, you get the ball lined up on the launch pad, and then boom, you follow the track. And there's only one way to go, all right? So, you know, you roll down this little ramp, and then, boop, the whole thing goes to another ramp that turns at a 90-degree angle. So, okay, you turn at a 90-degree angle, you follow that one until, oh, look, there's a little ramp, you have to drop it off into, there, now it lands on the next portion. Some of the little ramps have rails on the sides, some of them don't. There are sections where you have to scoot across these little tough spots, and anyway, it's fascinating. Go look online for Perplexus and just be amazed. And here's the thing. My wife and I saw these. My wife found them and then showed them to me. Found them before Christmas and said, hey, should we get these for the kids? Because there was a great deal where you could buy all three sizes and you'd get them for, you know, the deal wound up being like $15 a piece when it was all said and done, which was a great deal because they normally run $25 to $35 if you're getting them, you know, at Target or Walmart or wherever it is they sell them. And so it looked like a great deal. And then shipping and handling would have been like $30. And I was like, oh, never mind. We won't do it. But at the time we were looking at them, we thought, wow, those look really cool. You know, maybe a little too simplistic for the older kids, but you know, the younger ones really like this. We should try those if we can find them at a reasonable price. But we never found them. Well, now Yancey brings one into work like 3 weeks ago. And, it is not a simple kid's toy. I mean, it is. It's nothing but, I mean, it's a plastic ball with a marble inside, and you just roll it around. I mean, there's no moving, well, there's actually one moving part, but there's no real moving parts other than that marble. And so it just doesn't seem that complicated. You know, there's just one path to follow, you know, and it starts with number one at the beginning, and then, oh, now I've crossed number two checkpoint, number three, number four. There's 100 points going all the way around this map. And the first day I tried it, I could get up to maybe 20. I mean, it's really tough. You would think, you know, it's just one path. You just follow the path, turn it the right way. No, it's tricky. It's really tough. It took me until finally, 2 days ago, I finally crossed to number 100, all right, and just thrilled to death. And now it's time to see how fast we can do it. Because, I mean, I've spent hours playing this thing. We brought it home over the weekend and played it, shared it with my kids. That was the best part. When we brought it home, all the kids loved it. All right, everybody who touches it loves it. But all the kids loved playing it, but it was the five-year-old who would not put it down. I mean, hours straight. I mean, this is a kid with no attention span at all. I've never seen him give a crap this much about something that wasn't electronic. But he would not put it down. Just would not. And I felt bad for him because the very first time he touched it, 5 years old, first time he touches it, he gets to 27 on his very first try. There's one tricky part in there around 20, and he happened to jump it, and oh, boom, it landed. Perfect luck. He got right in there. He gets to 27 on his first try. Over the course of the weekend, I bet he put another 4 hours into this thing, and he never got past 27 ever again. But he didn't care. It was normally you would think 5-year-old would get a little frustrated after a while. No, he was not going to give up. He was so fascinated by the twists and turns of this thing. Same way I am. It's just the greatest toy ever. And I think it won prizes for being the greatest toy ever. And rightfully so. Yancey picked his up at a Cracker Barrel, of all places, where they were on sale for $8. They were just trying to clearance them out. And if we had known how cool it was going to be, I would have had him buy me 10, and I'd be giving away these things as gifts forever, because that's how cool they are. But since then, the best I can find is you go online, and again, the medium-sized one, $16-17 off of Amazon, if you want to get it there. I have no idea the prices on the other two yet. I haven't even looked at them, although I assume I will own all three of them within the next couple of months, because they're just that good. So check them out. Perplexus. Now it's time for a Nerd Culture Report.
I thought this was bowling for weirdos.
Oh, thank goodness you're still with me, Gonzo. Nerd Culture Report today is what I am calling the Marianne Effect. This is not an original thing, although I'm the first one to call it the Marianne Effect that I know of. But the whole concept of Ginger or Marianne? Which one? Yeah, Marianne. See, me too. Okay. How about Betty or Veronica? Right, clearly, Betty, right? Okay. WKRP in Cincinnati, Jennifer or Bailey? Oh, Bailey. See, Jennifer was the hot one. Lonnie Anderson, huge rack, obviously sexual, although a very smart, capable woman. She was one that kept the entire station going because Mr. Carlson was such an idiot. And yet, we all loved Bailey, right? Okay. More nerd example, Buffy versus Willow. Now, this is a tough one because Buffy's pretty hot, and she kicks vampire ass, and we love that. And yet, all the nerds had a secret thing for Willow. You know you did, because Allison Hannigan's just that cute. All right. So I was thinking about this, because it all actually came from a conversation about Jennifer versus Bailey and how cute we thought Bailey was and all of this. And I started thinking about all these different comparisons, because there's lots of examples of this from TV and movies, mostly TV, where they give you two regular characters, and one of them is more overtly sexual, more overtly hot in a traditional sense than the other one. The other one is the more cute girl next door sort of whatever. And I would guess, I mean, there's lots of choices you can make here, but I would guess for the Nerd Pride audience, I would guess most of us take the Marianne most of the time. That would be our preference. And what is it about that? See, now my brother Kyle has always said that it's just because you have a thing for accessible girls, that they seem more accessible. It seems more realistic. Like it's someone you could actually be with, someone you could actually meet and get to know and that would have a chance with. And so therefore, that's why you pick them, even though in your head, he would say, in your head, you know the other one's hotter. And if you thought you could land her, you'd definitely go for that one first. But you're just doing this because it's more accessible. And I don't think that's true. All right, I've always thought he was wrong on this one. And now that I'm in a position where I can argue my point and he can't say anything about it, I'll go ahead and make my case. I actually think that it's because in our mind, whether it's right or wrong, we stereotype people, all right? We categorize people. And I think in our heads, we have a set of traits that we find attractive, not just physical attractiveness, but personality-wise, that there are certain things that we like in a person, someone, who shares our interests, whatever. And I think that when we see, the choice between Bailey and Jennifer from WKRP, for example, we imagine that Bailey has more in common with us, all right? We see that character, that type, and we think that, she probably, has more of those things, more of those common interests with us, more of those nerdy pursuits. And so therefore, that's what attracts us to us. It's not just a physical thing, but it's a whole mindset, a whole personality thing. Even though when it comes down to Ginger and Marianne, the actress who played Marianne, and I can't remember her name right now, but she was, a beauty pageant winner before she was an actress, all right? I mean, she's a gorgeous woman in her own right, and a beauty queen, as it were, homecoming queen, prom queen kind of girl. So clearly, you would think she would fall on the Jennifer, Buffy, Veronica, Ginger side of things, but because of how her character was portrayed, she was stunningly beautiful anyway, but then they give her this hometown country girl sort of persona, and that is what really lured us to her. Now, in doing some research for this, I found myself at TVTropes.com or TVTropes.net, whatever the website is, TV Tropes, where apparently all of this is phrased in terms of a Betty-Veronica love triangle. They refer to it as the Betty and Veronica trope. And again, they usually talk about it more in terms of a love triangle where you have a character within the comic book or show or movie or whatever it is who has to make a choice between the two of them. And what choice they make really depends on the kind of movie and the intended viewing audience. You will quite often see the hero in these cases, you know, you wind up getting the lesson of, you know, making the choice of that hot prom queen, ultra desirable, gorgeous, whatever. And it's only after you go through some trials and tribulations with that relationship that you realize that, oh, what I was always looking for was right there under my nose the entire time. This is the basis of well, half of the John Hughes movies out there. He did it in Some Kind of Wonderful, where in the end, the guy gets the girl of his dreams, Leah Thompson, and only after he's got her realizes that, you know what, all I've ever really wanted is whatever the tomboy's name was, who was his best friend throughout the entire film. Which was also supposed to be, by the way, and I know you all know this, but I'm going to repeat it because it still makes me angry, was supposed to be the plot of Pretty in Pink. Thank you, God, I couldn't remember the name for the life of me. Where, you know, Molly Ringwald is supposed to be madly in love with Blaine, and she winds up getting Blaine, and everything seems to be working out, and it's only afterwards that she realizes that Blaine is this shallow, horrible, terrible person, and all she ever really wanted was Ducky, John Cryer, right there at her side the entire time. And, of course, that didn't go over well with test audiences, because it's John Cryer, for God's sake. So poor Ducky winds up being alone, and we throw him a bone with some mythical hot chick that we've never seen before who falls for him at the end. But that was supposed to be the plot, is that, you know, you wind up lusting after Veronica forever, you finally get Veronica, and then you realize, you know what, this isn't fulfilling, I really want Betty. And that's what we do. But for me, it's not even about the love triangle. It's not about, you know, watching a character make a choice and having to oscillate back and forth and whatever. It's just, for me, it's those situations like Marianne and Ginger, all right, like Buffy and Willow, where you're, as a viewer, you have two options, and which one do you like better? All right? And again, I could be completely off my nut here. I could be completely out of left field thinking that most of us would choose the Marianne. Most of us would choose Willow. But, you know, hey, I'll put it up on the boards. If you guys can come up with some other good examples of this, I would love to hear them. I'm fascinated by this whole concept. And if you've got any opinions, hey, share them. We'll bring them back here to the podcast. Really. You know what's up next? Roku! I love my Roku. I have been watching quite a bit of Instant Watch lately on my Roku box. Netflix is awesome. Everybody should have Netflix. Everybody should be watching stuff for free on their Roku box because, okay, I know you can watch it on your PlayStation or your Wii or whatever, but you really want a Roku. That's what you want. On my Roku box this last week or so, my wife and I have watched, did I mention United States of Terra last time? I can't remember if I mentioned it or not. All right. United States of Terra is a TV show that I think came from Showtime, and the main character, Terra, has multiple personality syndrome or dissociative personality syndrome. I don't remember what the official name of it is anymore. But she has multiple personalities, and she is, you know, she's married, she has two teenage kids, she has all the typical, you know, comic things that go on in sitcom life. But she also, by the way, has multiple personalities, and we get to watch these personalities come out and interact with the family and the way her family has come to accept them and how the whole dynamic works out. And so far, we're only a few episodes in, but it's just fascinating and truly funny. I'm really having a good time. So I recommend that one. Go watch it. What else did I see? I saw They Live. Can you believe that I have gotten this far into my life without ever seeing They Live? That movie's been out for 23 years now. 1988, I think. Anyway, starring Rowdy Roddy Piper. It is a sci-fi classic at this point. I mean, seriously, I'm here to chew bubblegum and kick ass, and I'm all out of bubblegum. That's where this came from. How have I never watched this before? Me, who loves badass movie quotes, has never watched They Live. So now I have. And I will tell you, this movie sucked. Oh my God, it was bad. It was totally bad. And yet, I couldn't turn it off. I had to watch it all the way through the end. Not a great movie, but fun in its own right. And of course, you have to watch it for the fight scene. All right, there's probably, much like chewing bubblegum and kicking ass, there are probably a dozen quotes like that that are completely off the ball. There's no good logical reason for him to say some of these things. They make no sense at all, and yet, oh, they're funny. It's just funny to listen to. But then there's that fight scene. The fight scene between Roddy Piper and the black dude whose name is Keith David. Keith David, who, by the way, I'm watching the movie and I'm like, I know this guy. I've seen him in a million things. How do I not remember? And then I go back and look it up, and it turns out that he's been in a bunch of stuff. He was Mary's dad from Something About Mary. He was one of the dudes in John Carpenter's The Thing. Apparently, this guy works more than almost anyone else in Hollywood. He's prolific. He's got a million credits to his name. You'll recognize him when you see him. But anyway, Roddy Piper and Keith David have this fight that never ends. It goes on forever. I mean, they are just pounding the crap out of each other, and it is an amazing scene. It has to be seen to believe. It's the same scene that was that they made fun of on South Park. Well, paid homage to on South Park when they had Jimmy and Timmy do their cripple fight, and they replayed that entire scene shot for shot. It's a spectacular fight. It is worth watching They Live just to see the fight scene and hear a few of these stupid one-liners, and then when you're all done, you can go, okay, I've seen it now. I'm done. And eventually when they make a remake version of They Live, because you got to know that sort of stuff is coming, right? Then you'll get it, and you'll know what's going on. But it was just fascinating. What else did I watch on Roku? I just saw Soap Dish. I told you several episodes ago how much I love Soap Dish, the movie, and I've only seen it a couple times. But it's on Instant Watch now. I put it in my queue way back then when I first talked about it, and I finally got around to watching it the other night. Watched it with my 8-year-old, of all people. He came in, he's like, what are you doing? I'm like, oh, I'm just watching a movie. And he's like, well, is it a bad movie? Because he's always worried that it's going to be something he's not allowed to watch. I'm like, well, no. I said, it's for grown-ups, so you probably won't get it, but you can certainly sit down and watch with me if you want. And he did. And I explained the pieces to him that were a little complex. And we both had a great time watching Soap Dish. It's Sally Field and Kevin Kline and Elizabeth Shue. And they play, it's a movie about people making a soap opera, but it's kind of a meta story so that the movie itself and the lives of all these people are like a soap opera as they make a soap opera. And it's just, it's good fun. I had a great time watching it. I love that film. I've always loved that film. So I had a great time. I'm just so glad it's on Instant Watch now. What else? Oh, and then last of all, Bunraku. Bunraku, I'm only halfway through because I have to watch it with a tie-in, my 14-year-old. And sadly, he's grounded right now. So we only saw the first half the other night, and then he had to go to bed, and now he's grounded. So I don't know when he's going to get TV back, so I don't know when we're going to be able to finish the other half of this movie. But Bunraku is, I think ultimately, it's not going to turn out to be a great movie, but it's a fascinating movie. The entire story, it tells the tale. It's a science fiction sort of thing, a future in which all firearms have been banned because of the last world war. And so now with guns being gone, we're back to everyone fighting with swords and knives and axes. In this very stylized world that is, they open it up by starting to tell the story in sort of a cross between kabuki and puppet theater, and then they maintain that feel for the entire movie. So the whole thing feels like a puppet show, but with live actors, and it's just weird, all right? And, I mean, all right, it's got Josh Hartnett as one of the heroes. It's got Woody Harrelson as the Obi-Wan-style mentor. At least I assume that's what he's going to be. Woody Harrelson, who is slowly becoming one of my favorite actors. I love watching Woody Harrelson in anything. I really do. He's just awesome. Ron Perlman. Just for you, Jeff, Ron Perlman is in this thing as the villain, and he's badass. Oh, God, he's awesome. And then as his henchman, Kevin McKidd. Who I always know as the dude from Rome. I love Kevin McKidd. Ever since I watched Rome, I see Kevin McKidd in all sorts of stuff. And every time I see him, I'm like, oh, dude, I love this guy. And sure enough, every time I see him, I love him. He can do no wrong for me. Demi Moore is in it. It's just, and it's only, you know, the movie's only like a year or two old here. And I think ultimately, I think the story is a little bit confused. I think they make some logical leaps or some, they assume a little too much. And so it's a little convoluted, but just for the style and the action and the fight scenes, really having a great time watching it. So probably next week or, well, whenever Italian's Ungrounded, I'll come back to the podcast and I'll give you a full review of it. But I'm just having a great time watching Bunraku. So we'll get to that one. So that is my week in Roku. And now?
And now for something completely different.
For something completely different. This is just stuff that I don't have a category for yet. And this one, I actually thought about naming this segment Fingertips and then stealing the They Might Be Giants song Fingertips, the intro of that, for my bumper music. But then I realized I wasn't going to be using licensed music as my bumper clips anymore, so I'm not going to do that. But my whole point here is for my something completely different portion, I've just got some little short things that don't really fill up a whole segment, but I wanted to make sure I talked about it. So on satellite radio, there is a radio host named Jason Ellis, has his own show, and he's very raunchy and very weird. He is or used to be a professional skateboarder. Anyway, he's into extreme sports. He's into boxing, fighting, skateboarding, lots of stuff. And he is racing trucks. And the big race that he goes to, it's hosted by or sponsored by Lucas Oil. Anyway, so because of that, he got the idea that he really wants to have his truck sponsored by George Lucas, either Lucasfilms or Industrial Light and Magic or something. But he wants to have his truck sponsored by Lucasfilms. And then when he goes to race it, he wants to have the entire truck painted to look like Jabba the Hutt. And then he would call it Jabba the Truck. And then he would modify the horn so that every time he slams someone into the wall, every time he knocks someone out, then he gets to blast the horn and it laughs like Jabba. Oh, 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 oh. I thought that was cool. I would love to see that. And of course, this is just cloud talk on his part. He's not really going to do any of this. But what a great idea. Also, in this segment, I just saw a movie trailer for a movie coming out next month. Have never even heard of it before, but it's coming to theaters in like 3 weeks here. Casa de mi Padre, all right, House of My Father, a Spanish language film, which, God, I don't even want to give too much of it away. But you have to go watch the trailer for it. It's on IMDb. Go to look up Casa de mi Padre. And watch the trailer, and I'll tell you what, it's an entirely Spanish language film, and it is a comedy that is mocking the Spanish telenovelas, the overly dramatic, extended TV series, miniseries that run in Latin American countries, and it is funny just on the basic concept. But even funnier when you realize that it stars, and I'll just tell you from the trailer, when they get down and they're listing off all the characters, and they list off all these Hispanic names, and then they get down to and introducing Will Ferrell. Yeah, it's Will Ferrell. Will Ferrell as Will Ferrell, playing whatever the lead part is. It's a Will Ferrell movie, and Will Ferrell literally does not speak English in this movie. I mean, he's playing it straight, and it just looks hysterical. Now, I say it looks hysterical, but, you know, then to me, the trailers for Anchorman and Talladega Nights and some of these others looked really funny. But as I've said about Will Ferrell, when he does characters like that, they're really, really funny for a while. They would be great as a Saturday Night Live skit. They would be great as a short film. But then when you take it and the whole joke is this character, you drag that joke out to 90 minutes, it starts to wear a little thin for me, which is too bad because most of the people I know, most of my family, loved Anchorman. They loved Talladega Nights. They could watch it over and over. They think this is great stuff. And for me, both of those movies just kind of left me flat. It just wasn't what I was hoping for. Again, funny, funny stuff, lots of good moments in them. And then by the end, it's like, okay, I'm ready to be done. The last 20 minutes of Anchorman was painful to me. So I'm imagining, again, it's a Will Ferrell movie, Casa de Mi Padre, could possibly turn into the exact same sort of thing. That, okay, hey, it's really funny that he's playing a Mexican noble. It's really funny that he only speaks in Spanish in a subtitled movie. It's really funny that they do all these overly dramatic jokes and plays. And then by the end of the movie, I think I might be tired of it. But we'll see. Because, you know, eventually I'll wind up watching it. I won't go see it in the theaters. I know myself. But I will wind up getting it on Netflix. So eventually, I'll find out. You guys can tell me if I'm right or wrong. Some of you will see it before I do. And then last of all, Whitney Houston died this week, which sadly, Whitney Houston dying means that there's 50-some points that are completely lost in our Deadpool because nobody had her in the Deadpool. It is so sad. But here's the deal. Whitney dies, and now it's not huge. It's not Michael Jackson big. It's not Amy Winehouse big. But you're still getting that response from people who, oh, how tragic. I always loved Whitney Houston. Oh, I always loved her movies. I always loved her music. Poor, poor Whitney. It's so sad. Okay, you know what? It's not sad. It is a waste of talent. I will grant you that one. All right? But Whitney Houston was a talented singer with a very, very strong voice who performed bubblegum pop songs and pop ballads when she was in her early 20s. And then she married Bobby Brown, and she turned to drugs, and she's been a lost cause for 30 years, people. I mean, honestly. All right? And so here was my wish, and I mentioned this on the boards. And I don't know why I always apologize for stuff that I've already mentioned on the boards, because I know most of you don't go to the forums, no matter how often I tell you you should. But anyway, I mentioned on the forums that if only I had a time machine. If only I had a time machine, and I could go back in time 3 weeks and take a huge opinion poll of people to find out how they feel about Whitney Houston 3 weeks ago before she died, and find out that, you know what, most people don't care for her. Most people think she's a joke. Oh, you know what, I liked a couple of her songs, but really, she's done nothing since then, all right? And then compare that to now with the tributes and the, a great loss to our country, a great loss to music. You know what, I don't think you guys mean that. Am I being disrespectful? Yeah, a little bit. But come on. Not like we didn't see this coming. This isn't a tragedy, all right? Because we've all seen it happening for the last 25 years. We've all known that this is what she's doing to herself. We saw her on TV being interviewed and talking about how she would never do crack. That's crazy. That's a poor person's drug. You know, with her money, she can afford much better drugs than that, if she were to do drugs, obviously. Which she claimed she didn't. So, you know, really. But enough of my miscellaneous segment. Let's get right into the, okay, here's where I would have put in some music, and this week's music was going to be, songs I've always wished I could sing at karaoke, but sadly, the karaoke dude doesn't have these. They were never made in a karaoke version. That's too bad. And the first one was going to be the Southern group Bama playing Sweet Home Alabama in a hip-hop version, which I love and I'm really good at, and would be awesome at karaoke, and yet they don't have it, and now I can't share it with you because it's licensed music. I'm sorry. So it brings us to the word of the week. This week's word, ketchup. All right. Again, I'm not worried about you guys using it in a sentence. You all know ketchup. You all eat ketchup. You love ketchup just as I do. And I saw on the Straight Dope, go to straightdope.com, Cecil Adams answers all your questions. And it was talking about what's the difference between ketchup and catsup when you spell it differently. And the answer was, we don't know. Ketchup seems to be the traditional spelling, but some people spell it catsup and we don't know why. That wasn't the part that fascinated me. Based on that, I went to go look up a history of ketchup because according to Cecil, ketchup comes from China originally. And so I went to look up ketchup, and the original ketchup, which was called in Chinese something pretty close to the word ketchup, ketchup was originally a condiment made from the brine left over after pickling fish. All right? So it is a pickled fish sauce, if you can imagine that, with some other spices and stuff added to it, which sounds really nasty to me. But then you gotta remember, I love Worcestershire sauce, or Winchester sauce, as my dad would call it. I love Worcestershire sauce. And you know what the primary ingredient in Worcestershire is? Well, not primary, but one of the main ingredients? Oyster? Really? Oyster? Who knew? Well, probably you did, but you do now for sure. So that was the original ketchup, is pickled fish brine, which sounds nasty as all get out. But the Chinese then exported that to Malay nearby, and the Malaysians used ketchup in almost exactly the same form. And then when the British moved in and took over everything, the British picked it up and loved it. They could not get enough of ketchup, this pickled fish ketchup, and loved it. And so they brought it back to England with them. And it wasn't until years later that someone came up, and I think like early 1800s maybe, because ketchup as we know it, or ketchup as it was originally created, has been around for 500 years maybe. All right, long time. But then somewhere in the 1800s, some clever woman came up with a recipe for ketchup made with tomatoes. Now we're getting closer to what we know now. And so you wind up with tomatoes and vinegar to get that pickled briny taste, and lots of salt, tons of salt as a preservative, and other spices mixed in. And this tomato ketchup winds up being the thing that brings tomatoes to the table in North America. Because up until then, most North Americans, most people living in America, assumed that tomatoes were poisonous because they're related to the nightshade family, and somewhere the rumor got started that tomatoes were poisonous. If you ate too many of them, you were going to die. But tomato ketchup was just so darn good, they couldn't stop themselves. And so then for a while, okay, people still wouldn't eat whole tomatoes, but you know, as long as it's mixed with other stuff, as long as you're mashing them up and putting them in a sauce and you're processing them in some way and adding all your salt, and okay, well, now you've somehow pulped the poison out of them. I don't know. But anyway, tomato ketchup is what is responsible for Americans slowly coming to realize that they love tomatoes and they can use them in all sorts of stuff. And so now we do, all because of ketchup. And of course, then eventually, originally, the original tomato ketchup was, like I say, extremely salty. Still is today, but extremely salty and acidic. And then somewhere along the line, someone said, you know, we need to cut that acid a little bit. And that's when we started adding sugar to it to give us the ambrosia that we have now. Oh, I love ketchup. But I know what you guys want. You want the badass movie quote of the week. No intro, no fanfare. We'll just get straight into it. Quote, "Dear Governor Axtell, I've heard that you will give $200 for my head. Perhaps we should meet and talk. I am at the Juarez village at the border. Send 3 men and instruct them not to shoot as I am unarmed. In short, sir, I surrender. Your obedient servant, William H. Bonney. P.S. I changed my mind. Kiss my ass." Unquote. That is a quote from Emilio Estevez playing Billy the Kid in the movie Young Guns from 1988. Young Guns. Guilty pleasure. Do you love it? Gah. Yeah, Young Guns is one that I know it's a bad movie. I know it's got all sorts of problems with it, but it's fun. I mean, honestly, Regulators! Seriously, you don't like that? That's great stuff. And so I enjoyed Young Guns the first time I saw it. I've enjoyed it every time I've seen it since then. It just plays on those adolescent male fantasies of being an Old West badass cowboy. I mean, that's just what it is. So anyway, I like the movie. I love that quote. There you go. The next music that you won't hear would be Randy Travis singing What'll You Do About Me. Randy Travis is a country singer. I'm not a country music fan. I don't listen to a lot of country music, but I love Randy Travis because he has got an awesome voice. Just very, very deep, deep country voice, and really good. And What'll You Do About Me is a song about, it's about a stalker. It's about the guy is singing, and he's basically telling the woman, yeah, okay, so we hooked up, we had a one-night stand, you thought that was it, but now I'm in love with you. What are you going to do about that, huh? Huh? And talks about, so, you know, What happens when you've got a man over for the evening? I'm standing on your front porch holding a 2x2 waiting for him to come out. Well, what are you going to do about that? It's a creepy, creepy stalker song, but very entertaining and very cool. And I'm not going to play it for you. So there. Which brings us to the Pod-O-Matic! Hot dog! This is the Nerd Pride Radio Pod-O-Matic. At the end of every cast, I bring out R2 in his fully pimped out Pod-O-Matic bubble. He rolls up random topics for me to talk about. And where do these topics come from, you ask? Well, that's where you come in. If you want to hear me haver on about something, send me your question or topic by email or, better yet, in a private message on our forums, and I will add it to the Pod-O-Matic list. Pod-O-Matic is about whatever you want it to be. And, by the way, thank you, the new users who've been signing up, the old users who keep contributing. Everyone's given me some Pod-O-Matics. I'm still up at, 250, 280 of them. We have got lots of Pod-O-Matic choices to choose from. And let's get straight into it. First one is number 73. This one comes from Billy Bob. Hey, Billy Bob. He says, I'm putting together a 21st century nerd time capsule. And by the way, 21st century nerd has the little trademark symbol after it, so apparently he owns that. To be opened in the year 3001. I've already included a bag of polyhedral dice, a copy of the first four seasons of The Guild burned onto DVD, and Joss Whedon's head preserved in a pickling solution. What do you want to add before I seal this baby up? Oh, I hate it when you guys catch me off guard like this. This is one that requires a lot of thought. I will open up the forums and let them add some stuff to our 21st century nerd time capsule. But for myself, clearly the most important thing we could possibly add, you already got the dice. That would have been my first choice, would be some dice. So instead, I am going to include every episode of the Nerd Pride Radio podcast, because that is what should be preserved for future nerds. It's what they need. Number 96. This one comes from Brasky. Brasky says, Star Trek question. What is number two's duty? You said duty. You said number two. Number 75. This one's also from Brasky. Brasky says, if you could get an hour to pitch your best game idea, I'm assuming it's Instant Game, even though you only co-created it with your brother Kyle Jones, who would you pitch it to? The person doesn't have to be alive, just in case you wanted to make a pitch to Anne McCaffrey. Ooh, too soon? Okay, well, no, it's not too soon, because you clearly submitted this right after she died. But boy, that would have been really funny back then. As it turns out, if I were to pitch my best game idea, and clearly I would pitch Instant Game because it is the best game I've ever created all by myself without any help from anyone else, I would pitch it to, whoever's in charge over at Paizo right now. I honestly think that removing the rules section from it and leaving it as just the instant creation portion of it, not worried about attaching my own rules to it, I think it's very marketable, and I think I just love Paizo, so I love everybody over there, and I would love to see them do something with it. But right now, I'm actually rewriting Instant Game. I think I mentioned that already. So I'm adding some stuff to it. We're changing up some stuff. I say we, even though clearly I'm doing it all by myself because I am the creator of Instant Game. I would love that. I really ought to do that. I won't. I won't actually submit the game anywhere for publication just because I don't know. It's just not my style, I guess. Maybe I'm scared. Is that what it is? Is it just because I'm a chicken? Maybe. But either way, I like giving it away for free. I like knowing that people enjoy it. In fact, go to nerdprideradio.com, click on the free games button on the front page, and you can find Instant Game in there, along with a bunch of other free stuff that my brother and I have created. So you'll enjoy that. Ooh! Oh my gosh! R2 just gave us number one. That's awesome. I said number one. All right, this one is from Sirius Paul. Sirius Paul asks, what happened to Pac-Man? Well, actually, if you've watched the Behind the Music segment on it, you'll find out that he actually went through rehab, and after a six-month stint, he's actually doing very, very well, and he's now a land developer, if you can believe it. So, there you go. Although, funny you should bring up Pac-Man, Paul. Because as much as, look, I loved Pac-Man when I was a kid until Atari made that crappy, crappy 2600 version of Pac-Man that was terrible and made me want to hate it forever. But I loved Pac-Man back in the day, and then it turns out that, you know, people nowadays are more into games with, I don't know, plots and endings. But Pac-Man just came up this last week because my 8-year-old had to make a Valentine's box for school because it was Valentine's Day. So he had to make up a box to, you know, we decorate a shoebox, he takes it to school, and all the kids put Valentine's in it for him. And completely on his own, I have no idea where he came up with this. I didn't know he had ever played Pac-Man or knew anything about it. He came to us and said, yeah, I want to decorate it with Pac-Man. Really? You want a Pac-Man Valentine's box? Okay, so we did. So we went out, we found a bunch of graphics, and we added some stuff to it. And so what we did was we wound up getting a full-size maze, a Pac-Man maze, like from the original game. And there's Pac-Man in it, and there's the ghosts in it. And for some reason, this version of the maze that we found just a picture of it online, all the dots were already pink. So all the dots are pink for Valentine's Day. And then we went in and we re-edited all the power pellets and the cherry in the middle so that they were all replaced with giant hearts. So we have hearts at the corners and hearts in the middle for the cherries. And then we plastered that. We printed it up on a big old sticker, and we plastered that on both sides of his box. And then he did a repeating pattern of ghosts that went over the top, and then his name down the sides. And it looks awesome. In fact, let's see. Yep, it's sitting right here in the chair next to me because Valentine's Day is over. He's already brought it home. In fact, oh, I shouldn't even have looked. I bet that thing's full of candy. Oh. But anyway, it's right here next to me, and it looks awesome. And my kid is so clever. We had a great time doing it. Number 8. Ooh, from Stan. Haven't heard from Stan in a while. Stan asks, off the top of your head, what's your favorite XKCD strip? Oh, all right. Off the top of my head, this is all right. First off, do you guys read XKCD? I assume all of you do. Go to xkcd.com. One of the greatest comic strips ever. Anyway, my favorite XKCD strips, and I can't remember the specifics of them because there are several of them like this. But anywhere that he inserts a your mom joke, or a your sister joke, or basically a twist ending where he implies that he's been sleeping with your mom or your sister or your girlfriend or whatever it is. And it's the same kind of joke every time, and they always catch me off guard, and I laugh my butt off at them. I love them. The only one I can remember is the one about Douglas is losing it at the Lincoln-Douglas debates, or he lost it after the Lincoln-Douglas debate, so it shows Douglas at the Gettysburg Address going, yeah, well, 47 years ago, your mom brought forth upon this continent a new nation conceived in liberty. And that's really, really funny. It's a great your mom joke. But he's got other ones like that. Man, I wish I could remember any of them in specific. But those are my favorites. I love XKCD, and I love those strips in particular. But the man makes me laugh. Number 50. This one is also from Stan. How'd you do that, man? Stan says, do you still kiss like a girl? Oh, you shut up. You don't even know, all right? That was a long time ago. You shut up. Number 24. Hey, Serious Paul. Serious Paul says, do you really think Batman could single-handedly kick the whole Justice League's ass? Yes. Of course he could. Have I not explained this before? All right. Here's the deal about Batman. Batman has no superpowers. He's just a dude with a lot of money and an obsessive mind. All right. And if you were to pit Batman versus Superman, Batman wins. Do you know how we know? Because of the original Dark Knight comic book series. In fact, it's not just Batman kills Superman. It's 70-year-old Batman kills Superman. He's a septuagenarian. The man is 70 years old, and he puts on the cowl, and he goes out, and he kills the eternally young Superman. Superman, who is still in his prime, as he always is. And Batman takes him down. You know why? because it doesn't matter how much you love Batman. It doesn't matter how good of friends you are. It doesn't matter what kind of trust or bond you have between you. None of that makes any difference. No matter how much you love this man and he loves you back, he still, in his back pocket, has a plan on how to kill you if he has to. All right? It's something that he has to think about. And he knows it. He knows exactly. And so when the time came to take down Superman, well, let's break out the kryptonite. Been planning on this for years. Can't believe it took this long to come up. And he did it. All right? And the entire Justice League, I will tell you right now, Batman has a plan on how to kill every member of the Justice League individually if he has to. And, oh, by the way, he's got a contingency plan for what he has to do if he has to take on more of them, more than one of them at the same time. All right? If he's got to take on the entire Justice League, all right, the entire roster, past and present, oh, you bet, he will do that and he will win. Because that's what Batman does. Batman is unstoppable. Number 37. Oh, hey! Oh, this is great. It's from Ravemaster. Hey, Ravemaster, welcome to the show. Ravemaster says, if I asked you what train to take from Chicago to get to Hawaii, what would your response be? Well, you get on the Chicago to Hawaii Express, clearly. I mean, whoa. All right, I've never done this before. Give me 2 minutes. 2 minutes. I'm going to pause this. I'll be right back. Okay, I'm back. It actually took 7 minutes, but you don't know that because I can edit these silences out. All right. I just went on Google, and I searched for how long it takes to fall through the center of the Earth. All right? Because here's the deal. If you were able to, let's leave aside, you know, heat and air pressure and all of this stuff. If you could dig a hole from where you are right now, straight through the very center of the Earth and right out the other side, and you jumped in that hole, and let's assume a frictionless ride. Let's take out terminal velocity and air pressure and all that. Let's assume a frictionless ride through the center of the Earth. Without friction, you would wind up falling through the center of the Earth and stopping just about at the surface on the other side. All right? And it would take you 42 minutes to do that. Seems about right, doesn't it? 42 minutes of falling, and I have no idea what your velocity at the middle of it is. By the time you hit the center and you're at your fastest velocity before gravity starts slowing you down on the return trip, I assume you're probably going something like 2,000 miles an hour or better. So thank God it's frictionless. All right, 42 minutes. Let's remember that. Because now, let's say you dig a tunnel. Dig a tunnel straight through the Earth that goes directly from Chicago to Hawaii, all right, which, as I just looked up, is a little over 4,000 miles as the crow flies. Look that up on asthecrowflies.com. I don't know if that was really the site I'm making that up. Anyway, dig a hole straight through the Earth. So not even as the crow flies. I guess it would be as the Zorn burrows. But anyway, straight through the Earth, and now let's assume we've got a frictionless tunnel that you can hop in your little train car in Chicago, and you just ride downhill, frictionless, remember, and when you get to the center, all right, now gravity starts slowing you down, and now you head back up the other side, and you'll stop right about Hawaii, right at the other end of the tunnel, all right? And it will take exactly 42 minutes. No matter where you cut through the Earth, whether you go directly through the center or you cut off just an arc, I don't know what those arcs are called. Anyway, just cut off a section. No matter how steep, shallow, whatever it is, if you're going straight through the Earth, it's going to be 42 minutes, the way gravity works on you. As long as it's frictionless, you come out the other side. So that is my plan, is I dig myself a hole from Chicago to Hawaii. I mount my little train in there on its frictionless magnetic rails, whatever it is, and 42 minutes later, boom, I'm in Hawaii. This is a perfect plan. The only problem with it is, of course, that I think by the center of that, I didn't actually measure it all out, but I would assume that on the center of that trip, when we're under California or so, we'd probably be like 500 miles under the Earth's surface, and I'm pretty sure we'd be dead. But let's just leave aside matters of heat and pressure and air resistance and all that stuff. 42 minutes. That is the best trip ever. Number 60. Ooh, all right. Again from Sirius Paul. Peter Pan versus Roger Rabbit. Who wins? I don't have a good answer for this one. I'm assuming that this is a This is an alphabetizing contest, in which case Peter Pan comes first. His double P comes before the double R. Other than that, wow, dude, this may be the very best matchup ever. Because I really don't know. I mean, they're really both kind of unkillable. I mean, unless you've got, you know, paint thinner or whatever it is that kills the tunes. And I don't think Peter Pan's got that. But, I mean, Peter Pan always wins. I mean, you've seen the stories. Peter Pan always wins. It doesn't matter what the odds are. It's a whole story device. He always wins. Roger Rabbit, I don't think, has that sort of immunity. But on the other hand, Roger Rabbit is a tune, and therefore pretty well unkillable. I mean, again, unless Peter Pan stumbles onto the paint thinner thing. So, this would be a hell of a fight, but I'm going to have to go with Peter Pan. And only for the reason that Peter Pan has the killer instinct, and Roger Rabbit does not. Roger Rabbit is a lover, not a fighter. And I think Peter Pan would be willing to fight to the death. That's what he does, even though, you know, there's not killing in the Peter Pan movies. I believe there is in the book. I mean, that's what you do when you play Cowboys and Indians, when you play Pirates, when you play whatever the kids' games were that Pan played with the Lost Boys. You know, there's dueling and killing and death. I mean, the kid fights all the time. And so I think, as a result of that, I think Pan will ultimately win out on this one. As much as I would love Roger Rabbit to take it, I don't think it's going to happen. Number 51. Another one from Billy Bob. Billy Bob, you always have the long ones. This one says, yelling fire in a crowded theater is universally listed as a prime example of what not to do when exercising your right to free speech. So, where is the best place to yell fire? And, a follow-up question, what's the best thing to yell in a crowded theater? Dude, you've stumped me. I have no idea. The very best place to yell fire? Well, one would assume that, you know, when you're on fire. But that's really dull. I guess the best place to yell fire would have to be at Mideast peace negotiations. That's all I got. You know what? You guys will come up with better stuff on the forums, but that's what I've got for right now. Follow-up question, what is the best thing to yell in a crowded theater? Yet nothing. I am trying to watch a movie here. Unless you're shouting and you mean it, unless you're shouting free candy, I don't want to hear it, all right? Because I'm trying to watch Katherine Heigl up here. You need to get out of my face. Number 94. This one is from Jeff Hawes. Mr. Hawes says, talk about an RPG that you read and enjoyed, but have never had a chance to play or run. Oh, dude, that's easy. The Collectors. The Collectors is a fudge-based game from Rogue Publishing, who also published my game, Pariah, my one and only independently published thing that I didn't have to put out myself. And The Collectors is a story about the players are agents of Hell who are sent to Earth by the Home Office, back in Hell, that's how they refer to Hell. But they're sent by the Home Office to collect souls. That's their whole point. And they get up here and that's it. That's the whole point of the game. You are minor demons with minor powers, and you're out here trying to pick up a wayward soul because this guy reneged on his contract and you need to come pick him up and bring him back home. That's it. And it just looks brilliant. Lots of fun, well written. I have a copy of it. I've read it and I love it. Never had a chance to play it. Would love to, though. Number 12. All right, Serious Paul says, in a fight between Polly Pocket and Rainbow Bright, who wins? Oh, geez. Okay, this is not as good a matchup as the last one. I wish I had rolled these in reverse order. Rainbow Bright would win, hands down. Why? Because Rainbow Bright has real superpowers, and Polly Pocket is, she doesn't. And that's it. That's the whole thing. Unless, of course, there's a Polly Pocket TV show that I have never seen in which she does have magical powers or superpowers or some other abilities that I'm not aware of. In which case, I don't know. We'll have to reconsider. But based on my extensive knowledge of both characters, I'm going to have to go with Rainbow Bright. All right, last one for today. Number 79 comes from Daz. Daz says, noting the distinctly uncanny relationship between Pi and the relationship of the sun and moon during a solar eclipse, leading man to the conclusion that the universe is in fact some great design of cosmic significance and humanity is not, as H.P. Lovecraft suggests, just a speck in an infinite sea of stars. Bearing all of this in mind, where the heck is Kyle's novel? Well, it's sitting by my bed. It's on my nightstand. I've read it, and I love it. That thing is great. Oh, my brother is a genius. And the last time I talked to him, he is two-thirds of the way through book two. So there's going to be, it's a trilogy. So he is more than halfway through the entire trilogy. He's two-thirds of the way through book two. I am so looking forward to reading the next one. I cannot wait. It's going to be exciting. And I'm not going to speak for him, but he has talked about he's pursued trying to get it published. And with the limited luck he's had, I think he's talking about ultimately simply publishing it himself through some print-on-demand publisher online. In which case, when it happens, you know, for whatever marginal rates he charges, you guys can hop in there and get a copy of it yourself, and you will want to because it's really, really cool. So there you go. That's where Kyle's novel is. This podcast is copyright 2012 by Nerd Pride Radio. The featured music this week was Nobody. The opening and closing theme is from Nothing by Nobody. And all my bumper clips were just voice sounds. No music at all. Sorry. If you feel like doing something nice for this podcast, head on over to iTunes and write us a nice review, or check out our Facebook page at facebook.com/nerdprideradio. But to be totally honest, the best way to talk to me is come sign up for our forums at nerdprideradio.com/forums. Sign up, send me a message, we will hang out, we'll have fun. Yep, kind of lonely without the music, isn't it? Sad. Don't worry, I'll find replacements. I'll get some public domain, some Creative Commons music, something that I'm allowed to use for free, and I will get something acceptable. I've been browsing around. There's some stuff there, but it's going to take me a little bit. But we'll get it all back together in short order, and you guys will love it. In the meantime, the music would normally be ending right about now, and this is where I would have done Anti-Captain Part 4, but I'm going to put Anti-Captain on hiatus for this week, and instead I'm just going to... I'm just going to recite Dennis Leary's rant from the end of his song, Asshole. So I hope that works for you guys. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to get myself a 1967 Cadillac Eldorado convertible, hot pink with whale skin hubcaps and all leather cow interior and big brown baby seal eyes for headlights. Yeah, and I'm going to drive around in that baby at 115 miles per hour, getting 1 mile per gallon, sucking down quarter pounder cheeseburgers from McDonald's in the old-fashioned non-biodegradable styrofoam containers. And when I'm done sucking down those greaseball burgers, I'm going to wipe my mouth with the American flag and then I'm going to toss the styrofoam container right out the side and there ain't a goddamn thing anybody can do about it. You know why? Because we got the bombs, okay? Two words, nuclear fucking weapons, all right? Russia, Germany, Romania, they can have all democracy they want. They can have a big democracy cakewalk right through the middle of Tiananmen Square, and it won't make a lick of difference because we got the bombs. John Wayne's not dead. He's frozen. And as soon as we find a cure for cancer, we're going to thaw out the Duke, and he's going to be pretty pissed off. You know why? Have you ever taken a cold shower? Well, multiply that by 15 million times. That's how pissed off the Duke's going to be. I'm going to get the Duke and John Cassavetes and Lee Marvin and Sam Peckinpah and a case of whiskey and drive down to Texas and... Oh, just shut up and sing the song, okay?